Parshas Pinchas deals with many areas connected with the entering of the Jewish people into the land of Israel. The parsha begins with, really, it's the culmination of the previous week's parsha, of Pinchas' reward. We know, we discussed it a little bit last week, when the Jewish people were enticed by the daughters of Midian, and the prince of the tribe of Shimon publicly had relations with the princess from the tribe, a princess from the house of Midian. And Pinchas came, Vayikach Romach Be'ado, with a spear in hand, and put an end to this relationship, and really an end to the plague that befell the Jewish people. And Pinchas' reward was a brit shalom, a covenant of peace, and a brit kunat olam, and having the priesthood come from him for all eternity. We then move to the next part of the parsha, which is the order to attack Midian. We're in source number one, Rabbi Kaplan. Because of what they have done, then the parsha continues, and this is really the preparation to go into the land of Israel. The new census that was taken of all the tribes, how many people were in each tribe, starting with Reuven and continuing on. Then it's the dividing of the land. Once the land was divided, Slavcha's daughter said, it's not fair, we have no brothers, so we get no portion in the land. And indeed, they do get a portion in the land if there are no sons and the daughters inherit. And then we have Moshe Rabbeinu being told to prepare for death, and Joshua being taken over, or being appointed to take over as the new leader. And the parsha ends with the korbanos, with the sacrifices that are brought in the temple. The question I'd like to ask is, aside from the fact that the common denominator among all these themes is the entering into Israel and the preparation for entering into Israel, is there perhaps another theme that we can glean from the parsha, a theme, a thread that runs through the parsha, which has implications and has lessons for our lives? And that's what I'd like to discuss today, the theme of Mesiras Nefesh, the theme of giving one's all and dedicating oneself unequivocally to a certain task or a certain person or a certain aspect of one's life. In order to examine the concept of Mesiras Nefesh, I'd like to have an introduction and then an introduction to the introduction. And when we finish both of those, I think we can then begin to look at the parsha and appreciate the concept of Mesiras Nefesh. Let's begin with the introduction to the introduction. It comes from Rabbi Tatz's book, Living Inspired, where he speaks about that the human comprises, in source 2a, the body and the soul, and the mind itself comprises an outer, more earthbound layer, and an inner, more elevated core. And we spoke about last week the concept of the different parts in a person, the guf, the parts of the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama. Today I'd like to speak about, within the mind, there are two parts as well. Continuing in source 3, there are two parts to the mind, an outer part, the mabat hachitzoni, the outer view or outer eye, and then there's the inner part, the mabat hapnimi, or the inner eye. The outer eye is easy to define through the five senses. It includes the rational or logical faculty. It's the finite, the measurable. It's things that can be tested and proved. The mabat hachitzoni, the outer eye, includes all those aspects of our lives that we have the ability to grasp with the five senses. We have the ability to understand and study. I know this is a table. I can measure this table. I can analyze this table. It's something finite. It's something that I grasp through this outer mind, the mabat hachitzoni. And then continuing in 4, all the aspects of our consciousness and consciousness itself, which are not included in this definition, comprise the inner eye, which is called the das, literally the knowledge. The das is intrinsic knowledge. It grasps things as they are and because they are, not because they can be measured or proved or expressed. In fact, the things which the das knows can never be expressed, proved, or measured. They are never physical or finite. No machine could ever contain any of the knowledge of the das. This inner aspect of knowledge is the you, the real you. The outer mechanical aspects of the mind, which can be duplicated by machines, are not you. They are simply one's tools. What is included in the das, in one's inner knowledge? So he continues in source 5, some of the components of das are the knowledge of one's own existence, the knowledge of the present, the knowledge of one's own free will, the grasp that life has meaning, the grasp of intrinsic right and wrong, and ultimately the grasp of the transcendental reality, the knowledge of God. And all of us who've taken a basic philosophy 1.1 at one point in our lives know that the concept that we exist is not something we can prove. Yet if you would go over to someone and ask them, do you exist? The answer is emphatic, yes, I exist. Prove it, I can't. Why? Because what can be proven is the outer eye, the mabat hachitzoni, the inner eye, the real person, the das, cannot be proven. It's something that's known. So he then continues and asks, how can one ever begin in Source 7 to think about them logically? The answer is simple and staggering. Just as the external mind must be used to grasp those things which are accessible to it, so too the das itself must be used for its material. One must never attempt to use the one mode of the material for the other. An example that he quotes from Rabbi Dessler in Source Number 8 is a fantastic example of a camera, wherein a camera can take a picture of anything in the world except for one thing, and that is the camera itself. You can't turn the camera in on itself. It can take things only outward. And that's the real understanding of our grasp of life, wherein our outer mind can take in the world around us, but it cannot take in the inner world. The camera can't turn in on itself. So how does one then access this inner part of us, this inner core, this real you? So he continues in Source 9, a direct building of the das is true meditation. And here two words are necessarily misleading. Those who understand meditation teach that one must, quote-unquote, switch off the mind in order to meditate. This instruction, like all das experience clumsily put into words, is exactly the opposite of what one understands. Switching off the mind is not meditation. It is unconsciousness. Relaxing, perhaps, but not meditation. Meditation is a switching on of the mind, but of course these words are meaningless. So the instruction is to switch off. However, what is meant is to switch off the external mind. That is exactly the way to activate the das. And he explains that the tool necessary to activate the das is a tool called silence. And he says, words are finite. Words, no matter how perfectly chosen and eloquent, are fragments of meaning. They are the bits and pieces which communication struggles to construct. One who is sensitive knows that the deeper the experience and the closer to one's core the subject being communicated, the more difficult it is to express. We know that in our own lives. If you want to really communicate something very deeply with another person, words just cannot convey what one really feels. And at times, words really are unnecessary. If you really want to convey the way you deeply feel, so silence is enough. Just being with a person and communicating in a nonverbal way at times communicates far more and far deeper than words could ever communicate. And he says, because this is the problem with words, that it's finite, that it constricts ourselves, this is the reason he explains, this explains, according to the Maharal, the stuttering of Moshe Rabbeinu. We all know, growing up as children, that Moshe Rabbeinu had a speech defect, as we understand it, and he stuttered. Says the Maharal of Prague, that's a very simplistic view of what really was going on in Moshe Rabbeinu's mind. The problem wasn't that he stuttered and had a physical defect. Rather, the opposite is true, continuing in 11. He could not speak well because of his perfection. He was holding in a world of truth where things are grasped as they are, grasped by pure das. Things grasped thus prophetically, essentially, could never be shrunk into words. To do so would be to reduce divine knowledge to a finite level. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu have a difficulty speaking? Because he was holding in that core aspect of das, in the knowledge of the real knowledge of the divine. to be able to take that essence, that das, that pure das, the words of the Elyon, the words of God Himself, and put them into a finite physical means called communication, called verbal communication, is impossible. And that was the stuttering. And explained so beautifully, with this in mind, we can understand the medrash that we've spoken about at length many times, the medrash of the child who learns the entire Torah well in one's womb. As we know, we've spoken about a number of weeks ago, the candle that's lit over the child's head where the child knows who they are. The child knows for what purpose it is being brought into this world. It's the das par excellence. It knows the real itself. And then what happens? When before the child is born, the angel comes and touches it on its upper lip, and it forgets everything. So continues Rabbi Katz, and he asks in Source 12, would it not make more sense that the angel should touch the child where? On the head? Where is the place of the faculty of memory, of knowledge on one's head? Why on one's mouth? So he says, in the middle of 12, but the inexpressibly beautiful idea being taught here, say the mystical sources, is that the blow on the mouth is a gift of speech. A blow mystically is always a challenge to grow, to develop a new faculty or level, and on the mouth, because that is the organ of speech. As the child gains the nucleus of the ability to formulate finite words, he loses the clear, intimate knowledge of the higher wisdom, not just simultaneously, but because of the gift of speech. Being articulate means being able to shrink things into definite, bounded form. And that is the exact opposite of being able to expand things into their unlimited essence. As a child begins to grow and begins to speak, simultaneous with that, when words come, is the loss of that intimate knowledge of self. And only miracle can reconnect the two, miracle or the work of intense silence. Silence develops the deep well of the personality. It's an obligation, not a luxury. There must always be more to a personality than that which can be expressed. If you can sum up what you are in a few minutes of talking, you are just that, a few minutes from beginning to end. No matter how much is discovered, revealed, there must be infinitely more. And we know that when Parshas Pinchas does not fall out during the 3 weeks like it did this year, the Haftarah for Parshas Pinchas is Elijah on Mount Sinai, where he has this divine revelation from God, where God appears to him in a fire and an earthquake and a great wind, and God is not found in any of the above. But rather, God is found in a cold, mama daka, a silent, still voice. It's very fascinating that the mama daka, this silent voice, is called what? It's called a kol. There is a sound of silence. Just like darkness is not the absence of light, but rather an entity in and of itself, silence is not only the absence of words, but silence has a voice, has a sound in and of its own. And I believe that this is challenge number one that we need to face, each and every one of us, with ourselves, is to try to find that cold mama daka, that silent inner voice, wherein God was found on Mount Sinai in his revelation to Elijah in our own lives. What is our inner das? What is the real person? How do we define ourselves? You know, so often, we're at a simcha, we're at a party, and you meet somebody, a friend introduces you to another person, you begin to talk, and they say to you, tell me something about yourself. And I would say that 9 times out of 10, I would even say almost 10 times out of 10, a person responds to the question, tell me something about yourself, with what? Very good. Exactly. I feel good. With a profession. I'm a doctor, a lawyer, a candlestick maker. It's irrelevant what one does. But is that really the inner eye? Or is that the tools lent to a person in this world? You know, it reminds me of the famous story of the professor in a New York university who was an ethics professor who did not act ethically. And when the college board confronted him about this and said, you know, as an ethics professor, you should be acting ethically, his response was, do you expect from the math teacher to be a parallelogram? And that, in reality, is a very deep answer. Because although many times your profession can be an extension of self, and it can't be the reflection of the inner eye, it's not always necessarily so. Challenge number one is to find the inner eye, to find that inner das, to find that kol dmama daka, that inner voice of silence. And then, it doesn't end there. We now move to introduction number two. This is the introduction to the topic. This is just the introduction to the introduction. And that is, once you found that kol dmama daka, the inner voice that defines the real you, how do you manifest that in this world? How do you bring that to fore? How do you take it from the innermost intimate part of self and develop it in this world? And I would suggest today that one of the means of doing this is a concept called Mesiras Nefesh, the concept of giving oneself totally to whatever it is that defines you. There's a wonderful essay, which I'd like to just go through segments of, Rav Chaim Shulevitz Zatzal in Sichos Musar. The essay is called Teva Noach, where he states as his thesis of his essay, and this is source 14, Bo ure'e eze shefa shel koach, come and see the power of the strength, nichnas bechomer ayidei ha-mesirut va'ava shemashkia bo yotro. See the effect that happens when you put your all into a project. And he gives some wonderful examples that I'd like to share together. We'll do them outside. The first example is the example of Chana, the daughter of the mother of Shmuel HaNavi. Chana, we know, was barren for many years and was unable to have children. And then she was privileged to have this child, Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the prophet, who was at a young age dedicated and brought up to God. Lived in the Mishkan, lived in the tabernacle. And there's a wonderful verse, and sometimes these small, innocuous verses carry so much in terms of power and in terms of meaning. There's a verse that says that Chana used to come up to the temple and make a little coat for Shmuel. So it seems like a very sweet little detail, but why do we need to know it? So it says Rav Chaim Shulevitz, and it's so powerful. He says, do you know what was special about this coat? We find that this coat grew up with Shmuel. Like in the desert, the Jewish people's clothes grew with them. Shmuel's coat grew with him. And we find, if one studies the book of Shmuel over and over again, he's found in this coat. To the point when the Balat Ov, the soothsayer, brings up Shmuel HaNavi from the grave at the request of King Saul. Shaul HaMelech asked him, well, who did you bring up? What does he look like? And the soothsayer's response is, somebody who is wearing a me'il, wearing this coat. He was known by this coat. Says Rav Chaim Shulevitz, what was so special about this coat? And he says, 17, Et kol dimoteha v'tfiloteha, et kol avata v'chol liba nitna chana nevia, etoch ha-me'il ha-katon hazeh. Do you know what Chana put into this coat? All her tears, all her love, all her aspirations for this child. All her love for the Jewish people. All her love for God. Every stitch in this coat had love in it. Had Mesiras Nefesh, had giving of her whole being of what she wanted her son to be. It just wasn't a regular coat. It was a coat that had within it such power, such love. And says Rav Chaim Shulevitz, do you know why Shmuel HaNavi became the prophet he became? That why he had such Ahavas Yisrael, love for the Jewish people, that was unique about Shmuel, is that he went from town to town teaching the Jewish people? From where did he gain this love? From the coat. The coat absorbed the love of his mother, the tears and the prayers of his mother, and it entered into him. And he continues the same thing with Teva Noah, the Ark of Noah. 120 years Noah is building this Teva. That's a very long time to build an ark. What was in this ark of 120 years? It was his love for God, his determination to try to bring the people back, and his selflessness to bring a way of godliness into this world. Do you think that this ark could physically withstand 40 days and 40 nights of rain? What was the power of the ark? The power of the ark was what Noah put into the ark. That was the power of the ark. And he continues and he says, we have this concept as well, where our rabbis tell us that when the Beis HaMikdash was around, this is source 22, the altar used to be mechaber, used to atone a person's sins. And now that the temple is not around, what is mechaper? What atones for a person's sins? The shulchano shel adam, man's table. And he says the same thing. When you invite guests in on your dining room table, and you feed poor people, and you give them words of encouragement and words of comfort, that table is just not a piece of wood. What is that table? That table is your investment into the mitzvah of achnasat orchim. That table is just not a physical piece. It's a piece that reflects so much of you and of the fulfillment of the mitzvah in that table. And that table turns into a mizbeach, an altar. It's a different way of looking at life. We don't normally think of inanimate objects of carrying in themselves a certain power, a certain koach, but they do. It could be a coat, it could be a table, or it could be an ark. A person's investment of entire being and self has the ability to transform these items into something very special. And if this is true of inanimate objects, continues Rav Chaim Shulevitz, can you imagine if you invest something of this quality into people? And the example that he gives is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Medrash tells us, has 10 names, but yet throughout the Torah he's called Moshe. And why is he given the name Moshe? We all know, ki min ha-mayim yishitihu, that the daughter of Pharaoh drew him out from the water. Says Rav Chaim Shulevitz Atzal, do you know what Mesiras Nefesh, what intense giving of all was necessary for the daughter of Pharaoh? Here there was an edict that every child should be killed. And what is she doing? She's taking a Jewish child and keeping them alive. And not only keeping them alive, what did she do? She raised the child. She gave of her entire being to that child. From the waters I drew him is just not a physical reality. She brought him up from the waters. It describes emotionally what was involved with this child. And says Rav Chaim Shulevitz, it's almost wild. You know, when Moshe Rabbeinu is up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights and doesn't eat, doesn't drink anything, and gives himself entirely to the people, and the climax perhaps is at the sin of the golden calf, and God says, from you, Moshe, I'll make a nation. And Moshe responds, Mechenina Mesifracha, erase me from the book, Asher Katavta, that you're writing, I'll have nothing to do with it. Says Rav Chaim Shulevitz, from where did Moshe Rabbeinu get this Mesiras Nefesh, this ability to give himself completely over to the people? From where did he draw this character trait? From the daughter of Pharaoh, who invested it in him. When one invests one's complete self in something or someone, it has effects for generations. There's a certain power in the Mesiras Nefesh. It's like an interesting exercise to do. If we were to imagine ourselves at our 100th birthday party, and we have around us our children, our grandchildren, with God's help, our great-grandchildren, maybe even another generation, and at a 100th birthday party, it's kind of hard to figure out what present to give a person because, thank God, they've had a good life, experienced the pleasures of life. So you come up with a brilliant idea. The children and grandchildren decide to present you with a book. And this book is all the different activities that they have done, all the different aspects of their life that they have done, that have been a direct result of that one item that you as an individual have immersed your nefesh for, that you as an individual have given your all for. And how they've been able to inculcate this idea in their lives and how they've developed it in their own individual lives. And the question we need to ask ourselves is, what would be the title of that book? What is it about ourselves? What is that called Ramah Daka that we put in our all for? That we want our children and our grandchildren and future generations to learn from? And it works the opposite way too. Go back two generations. What were our grandparents' major Mesiris Nefesh that we take with us in our lives? And I think the power of Mesiris Nefesh and the ability for Mesiris Nefesh to go from generation to generation, this is the theme of Parshas Pinchas. And I'd like to take a look together at three examples in the Parsha where we see this concept and this theme of the power of Mesiris Nefesh. Example number one. The Parsha begins off, it's the source 27, where Hashem spoke to Moshe saying, Pinchas, son of Elazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, turn back my wrath from upon the children of Israel, when he zealously avenged me among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel my vengeance. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant and a peace, and it shall be for him and his offspring after him a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he took vengeance for his God and he atoned for the children of Israel. Ask the Nesivos Shalom a very, very simple question. And this will do outside sources 28 through 30. He says the following. It seems from this text that had Pinchas not come and taken the initiative and killed this prince from the tribe of Shimon and this princess from Midian who were involved in this act, what would have happened? It seems from the text that because of what he did, God did not consume the children of Israel my vengeance. That had Pinchas not come along and do this act, what would have God have done? He would have destroyed the entire people. Now that seems a little bit harsh. The prince of a tribe is involved in something, and because of that, you're going to kill the entire people? I can understand the chet ha'egel, the sin of the golden calf. That's pretty intense. Many people worshipping idols. But here you have a couple of people involved in this act, and because of that, the entire people are going to be wiped out? Seems a little bit out of proportion. So it says in Sivas Shalom something so fascinating, so beautiful. It's so important for our lives. He lays down the following concept about tshuva, about repentance, and it's great. He says, when a person is about to sin, the rabbis tell us a person doesn't sin unless nichnasah bo ruach shtut. Foolishness enters into you. When you're sinning, it's almost like, if we can picture it in almost childlike terms, a big monster overtakes you. And it's not you who are sinning. It's this desire that is larger than life, that looms over you, that says, you must speak this evil. You must do this negative thing. It's not really me. It's this power that, so to speak, has consumed me. So when I'm involved in the act itself, I'm really not me. I'm this being that overtaken me. And then what happens? I've spoken whatever it is I shouldn't have spoken. I've done whatever it is I shouldn't have done. And now that monster somehow shrinks back to size, and I'm back to me. And I look back and I say, now, logical, cool, calm, and collected, I did that. That was really inappropriate. The moment I did it, I was not really cognizant because I was overtaken. But afterwards, and this is a concept of tshuva, I can turn back and say, I really feel bad for what I've done. I can't believe I've done it. Now, this is the key part. Says the Nesivos Shalom the following. We have a halachic principle he borrows from the laws of kashrut. And most of us are familiar with this in terms of the laws of Pesach, of turning something from chametz to be able to use for Pesach. So we take, for example, there are three levels. One is things that were involved in cold, which means, let's say, glasses that I drink juice from. So if I want to take chametz glasses and I want to use them on Pesach, so I soaked them in water for 3 days and I changed the water every 24 hours. It came in contact with cold, so I am able to kosher it through cold. And then we have the concept of, let's say it came through a medium of water and fire, so I will kasher it through Hagala, blowtort. And the halachic concept is kivlo kach polta. The way it is sucked in, that is the way you bring it out. Says in Siva Shalom, the same thing is true of tshuva. You want to know how to do tshuva? Look at what mindset your mind was at when you did it. There are some sins we do which are like the cold water type. We're involved, but not really emotionally involved. So then to say to God, I'm sorry, it was enough. And then there are other sins that we have the heat of passion in us. And therefore, our tshuva has to be the same way in the heat of passion. And then there are other sins that are beyond the heat of passion. They're totally consuming us. And those need libum, those need a blowtorch type of tshuva. Explain to the Siva Shalom, when this prince, when Zimri, was involved in this act, the people stood around and watched. We saw in last week's parsha, they're standing around and crying. They weren't involved in the sin. They were not emotionally connected to this problem. Therefore, says the Siva Shalom, why are they held responsible? Because not being involved in this problem, they should have reacted with the same passion with which the act was committed. Since they weren't involved, their responsibility was to act to what was going on. And their problem was they were crying. That's too bad. This was being done with an act of passion. Crying is not sufficient. What was the greatness of Pinchas? Continuing in Source 31, he took a romach biado, he took a spear in his hand, as the rabbis explained. Romach is the letters resh mem ches, which is a numerical value of 248. He took his whole being, and he stopped what was going on. And this explains in the Siva of the Lushan in Source 33, for this act of Pinchas, this serious nefesh, this giving up his entire self, responding fire with fire, so to speak, Pinchas was rewarded with a brit kunat olam with the priesthood. And it's interesting to note that it's not just Pinchas who gets this reward, but because he had this serious nefesh, because he gave himself entirely for this, the reward goes on for generation and generation for all eternity. Because as we saw, the power of Mesiris Nefesh is, it doesn't only affect you. If you give yourself totally to something, it has ramifications for generations to come. As we see this, that when you give something of yourself to something, it has ramifications. In the next story of the children of Slofchad, in a later story, the children of Slefchad, the daughters of Slefchad, want a portion of the land. And the rabbis explain that they had within them the character trait of Mechavavot et Ha'aretz. They had a tremendous love for the land. Where did they get this love of the land from? So our rabbis explain, based on the fact that they're called from the family of Menashe, son of Yosef, they got it from Yosef, their forefather, who was also Mechave Vet Aretz. He loved the land. He readily admitted in jail, Ivri Anochi, I am a Hebrew. Although at that time, we see from later sources, it was a derogatory thing. But because of his love of the land, he stated emphatically, I'm from the land of Israel. And says Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal in Drash Moshe, this attribute of Yosef is something that his descendants took with them, and this is what Benot Slavchad had. They were going to enter into the land. They could have easily said, if we love the land, so we'll be in the land. So the fact is, we don't have our own inheritance, no big deal. No. Mechavot et Aretz men, they said to Moshe Rabbeinu, it's not enough that we're going to be in the land. We want what? We want a part of the land. And it's interesting, Ramosha, as this is almost parenthetical to us, he says, it's not enough to love Svarim. It's not enough to love books. What should you do? Own the books yourself. If you really love something, then you'll want to acquire it. And this is why Benot Slavchad, our rabbis explained, didn't want to get married. because they were afraid that they would lose whatever inheritance it would be to another tribe until they ultimately married within that tribe. This is love for the land. We're not satisfied with us being in the land. We want our own piece of land. We're not going to get married until we ensure that this land remains in our family. This is the power of Mesiras Nefesh. It carries down for generations. Third example of Mesiras Nefesh. When Moshe Rabbeinu saw that the daughters of Slavchat inherited the land, explains Rashi, and this is source 39, Moshe hoped that just as Slavchat's share in the land would go to his daughters, so would his own sons succeed him. And that's why the next story is, Moshe says, you know, God, I know I'm about to die. You can't leave this people without a leader. It will be like sheep without a shepherd. To which God says, okay, take Joshua and make him the new leader. Make him the successor. And the rabbis explain, the Medrash says, that God said to Moshe, your children did not study Torah, but Joshua did study Torah. He was in the Beit Medrash, he was in the house of study from morning till evening, and Baal was setting up the house of study. He deserves to get this position. So as for Nachlat Eliezer in source 41, you think it would even enter Moshe Rabbeinu's mind that his children would take over? We don't even hear Moshe Rabbeinu's children. Where did Moshe Rabbeinu think that his children would have the ability to be the next leaders? So the Baal Yalkut Lecha Tov, based on Nachlat Eliezer, gives the following understanding, which is true for life. He says, you know, in reality, Moshe Rabbeinu's children were on the same level of Torah study as Joshua. But there was one difference between them. And that difference is not being satisfied with what you have, but going beyond. And he says that this is really in contradistinction to Western culture. In Western culture, it doesn't matter if somebody spends 3 days on a job or 3 hours on a job. What counts is the job gets done. A person can work for 5 years on a PhD thesis and have it denied. Does the person get the doctorate? The answer is no. In Judaism, it doesn't work that way. You spend 5 years learning. You may never master a masechet in the Talmud, a tractate in the Talmud, but you get credit for every single minute you're putting in to learning that Torah. What counts is the amount of effort, the amount you give. Because every person, explains the Yaakov Lecha Tov, has different amount of capabilities. And what counts is not the result. What counts is the process. So you might have Moshe Rabbeinu's children and Joshua, Yoshua, on the same level. And if you give them a test, they would get the same exact mark. Ah, so then why not take Moshe Rabbeinu's children and make them the leaders? Because the process involved was a different process. What did Yoshua have? He had Mesiras Nefesh. He put in his all. He may not have been the most brilliant of leaders, but he had a characteristic much greater than brilliance, and that's perseverance. And that's getting up early in the morning and setting up the benches, and getting up and putting out the books, and really showing a whole self involved in this project. And this, Rabbi Hirsch explains in the 19 letters, source 46, our purpose in life, therefore, is not the acquisition of possessions. We should not measure our achievement in life by the volume of outer or inner treasures that we accumulate. Our life's mission is concerned with what we become, what we make of ourselves, and what we give, not what we get. We should measure our attainments by the extent to which we fulfill God's will. Our outer and inner acquisitions, utilizing every single one, small or large, for truly human deeds of divine service. And it continues in B, all one's capabilities are but tools lent to you, which one day will appear before the throne of God as witnesses for or against you, testifying whether you neglected them or used them well, whether you were a blessing with them or a curse. And he says something so powerful. Accordingly, there's an outer, universally applicable criterion by which to judge man's deeds, whether or not they correspond to the will of God. And there's an inner criterion by which to judge a man's greatness, which differs from case to case, not the sum total of his achievements, but the amount of resources with which he has been endowed, and whether he has used them to the best of his ability to do God's will. Not everyone is created equal. Not everyone is created with the same abilities. If a person moves from A to B and they gave their all, they are a much higher level than a person moves from A to M and they could have moved to T or S. It's not the amount that we accomplish, it's how much of self do we put into it. Some people are very blessed with an artistic talent, with whatever talent it may be. And then to produce the work and to say, look at what I've produced, and then sit back and say, well, I've done it. You could do far more, far more. And that's what you're held accountable for. Perhaps the most powerful story, which is a familiar story, but a powerful story nonetheless, an inspirational story, which reflects this, is the story that the Netziv, who we mentioned earlier, the Netziv of Voloshin told. He made a big party at the time he finished his first compilation, his first work. And the Netziv wrote a tremendous amount. And the people asked him at this party, you know, it's very nice that you finished this set, but why are you making such a big party? And he explains the following. And he says, when I was a little child, 9, 10 years old, I was up one night and I heard my parents crying in the kitchen. And as all of us who've all been children know, that when your parents are crying in the kitchen or are talking quietly, what we do is listen. We all know that. That's basic ABCs. And he heard his parents saying, his father saying to his mother, I know we wanted our son to be a great Talmud scholar, but he's just not cut out for it. I just met the Malamed, the teacher today, and he says, enough is enough. Your child is out to lunch even when it's not lunchtime. There's no hope for your child. No other option but to apprentice him with a shoemaker and let him learn a skill at that age, 9, 10, if they weren't cut out for learning, they were in the business world. I got married very young, 13, 14. So life started on a little bit different level than today. The Netziv saw how much it pained his parents that he wasn't successful in learning. And he came running out crying and said, please, please give me one more chance. One more chance. It says in the Netziv the following. He says, I can imagine after 120 years, I would have gone up to heaven. And God would have said to me, tell me something about yourself. And I would have said, I was a shoemaker. And God would have said, were you an honest shoemaker? And I would have said, yes. And did you pray 3 times a day? Yes. And were you involved in doing mitzvahs? Yes. And I would have felt great about myself. And then God, kivyachu, would have taken me by the hand and brought me into a study. And he showed me on a bookshelf all these books. And I said, oh, very nice, God. And he said, you know what? You were supposed to write all these books. And he says, in life, sometimes we're very happy and complacent and we think we're doing a great job, when in reality, we have that much more within us that we could accomplish. And they say that about the Netziv. His brilliance did not lie in physical brilliance. He wasn't necessarily the most brilliant Talmud scholar. What was his brilliance? His hasmada, his diligence. That he kept on at it, he plugged at it time after time. And I think this is why it's such a powerful story. It's a question we need to ask ourselves. We turn to ourselves right now and say to ourselves, if we were to enter the divine court, would we be able to say we are the best we are? The question is there a room that God has waiting up there for us with what we could have accomplished with what he gave us? And are we satisfied with what we are? Are we able to really find that kol dmama daka, that inner voice within us, that voice that really determines who we are? And are we able to say, I'm being moser nefesh, I'm giving my all to whatever it is I believe I am? So when we walk up into that room, the Netziv will recognize all those books and say, yes, those are the books that I wrote. And then we come to the end of the parsha. The end of the parsha is the korbanos, is the sacrifices. And I think that this is a perfect culmination of this theme of the power of Mesiras Nefesh. Because we need to understand that when we are Moser Nefesh, when we give ourselves to whatever it is, the question is, why are we giving of ourselves? What's the purpose? And that's what the Korbanos answer. Turning to the last page, source 52, Rav Schwab Zatzal, Mayan Beit HaShoiva, explains on the Medrash so beautifully that there were different animals that were brought on the altar. There were sheep, and there were bulls, and there were rams. And all of these animals, he say, reflect different character types and typologies of people. But what do they all have in column? The end of 52 underline, עניין הקורבנות המרות על מסירות הנפש של כל צום מריתו של הקדוש ברוך הוא לעשות רצון קונם וחפץ צורם. They're all brought on the altar. They're all there to give of themselves completely for God. Continuing in 54, the point is, the last line, נחת רוח לפני הקדוש ברוך הוא שאמר ונעשה רצונו. Are we doing through our mesirus nefesh a nachas ruach for God? Are we creating a kvod shamayim? Are we creating God's presence in this world? Are we bringing down godliness through the act that we're doing? And I think that this question is in essence what the 3 weeks which we're now involved with between Shiva Sarva Tammuz and Tisha B'Av is all about. What is the essence of the 3 weeks? We go through a mourning period over the temple. What does that mean? Temple was destroyed thousands of years ago. How is it relevant to me? I think this is one area how it's very relevant. Without a temple, we don't have God's presence nearly as manifested as when it was around. A person sitting here right now through this year and saying to themselves one of three things. I don't know what this cold mamad daka within me is. I'm frustrated. I don't know. What is that one item that really expresses me? Or, second, if a person is saying to themselves right now, I may know what it is, but I don't feel that I'm moser nefesh, I'm giving of myself completely to this thing, and I'm frustrated. Or, number three, a person is saying, I know what it is, right, even a higher level, and I know I'm moser nefesh for it, I know I'm giving myself to it, but I don't feel as connected to God as I would like to. Any of those three, you have now fulfilled what the Avelus of Yushalayim is. That's the mourning of Jerusalem. That frustration that we're not connected with God as we could be. That we don't have as close a relationship with God as we would like to. That we don't feel we're bringing God into our lives. It's almost like our job is a concentration board where you have to turn over the piece and then behind all the pieces is a part of the puzzle. Each and every one of us is a piece, and the puzzle spells out Kvod Shamayim. And one needs one piece in order to get the entire picture. You know, this concept of trying to bring Kvod Shamayim closest to God into this world, I have learned to a certain degree from my little old daughter. She's 8 months old now, Admeav Esrim Shana. And she's at a stage now, and those familiar with this age know, that while I'm in the room with her, no matter what she's doing, she's happy, she's smiling, everything's great. And then she has this inner sense, and I don't know from where, that if I tiptoe out of the room, she suddenly stops with whatever she's playing with, and you see those eyes following me wherever I'm going. And as long as she sees me, she's happy. As soon as I move out of her eyes vision, what happens? Cries. And I come back in, very happy. Now, it happens that I may be in a different part of the room where she can't see me, but I can see her. And I say to her, Rachel, I'm right here. It's not, that doesn't what matter to her. I say, Rachel, I can see you, don't worry. It's in her mind, it doesn't matter that I can see her. What's important to her? She can see me. And I think that this is such a Musar Haskell, such a lesson in what the 3 weeks is all about. This is what we should learn from her. If we don't feel God, we don't see God, it's not enough that God sees us. We don't see God, we should be crying. He's moving out of our view, and that should be room for concern. The way we should be happy is if we feel the godliness near us. And if we don't, that's a problem. And I think that this, in essence, explains the prayer that we say every day at the conclusion of our silent prayer of the Shemoneh Esrei, where we say, and this is 58a, we pray, Shibana Beis Hamikdash Vimhei Rabbi Yameinu, God should rebuild the temple speedily in our time. And then we say, V'tein Mechalkeinu B'Sarasecha, and give us a portion in your Torah. And the obvious question is, how do the two connect in one sentence? Very nice. We should have the temple be rebuilt. Very nice. We should have a portion in God's Torah, whatever that means. Very nice. But how do the two interconnect? Explains about Sifte Chaim, Rav Chaim Friedland, does that sound very, very beautifully. When the temple is around, every single person knows their piece in the puzzle. Every person knows clearly what they are put in this world for, because the divine manifestation and revelation is so apparent, is so strong, we know clearly what is our kol dvama daka, what is our silent still voice, and what we need to do. That's v'tein chalkenu v'sarasecha. That's our portion in Torah. What is our portion in this concentration game, lahavdil, bringing God to this world? And that's our tefillah. And this is a tefillah, really, of the 3 weeks. That we ask for the Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt in order for what? That we know what it is that we're supposed to be doing. And then once we know what we're supposed to be doing, then all it entails is Mesiras Nefesh, is giving our all to this project. Let's just sum up the ideas that we saw today. I think the theme of Parashat Pinchas is the theme of the power of Mesiras Nefesh, of Pinchas, who takes this act of responding fire with fire and is rewarded with not only him being the Kohen, but the priesthood is in all generations. The Ben Tzlafchad, who taken that theme of Nechavot et Haaretz, the love of the land, from their ancestor, from Yosef, and as well as Yahushua, that his greatness lied in the fact that he was able to give his all, everything he was, to the study of Torah, to the continuation of Torah, and that's what made Yahushua so great. And I think the challenge that lies within all of us is to find this kol dvama daka, this inner silent voice within us, the inner das, that inner knowledge. And it cannot be done through the intellectual means. It has to be done through the emotional means. Each type has to be dealt with its own type. To find that silent voice, and then to take that and give our all, total Mesiras Nefesh, to that project. Although we may be involved in lots of projects, we may be involved in lots of different aspects of our lives, there's always going to be one area that we are going to give of ourselves completely. And we need to understand that this has a double effect. It affects future generations, and it affects ultimately that there's a kvod shamayim, the inyan of the korbanos, that God's name, God's glory will be manifested in this world through the amount of energy we put in.